Welcome to Scenes, conversations in culture with the people who know it best. We chat with guests across music, art, fashion, film, sport, and technology in a bid to understand the scenes we love that little bit better. I'm your host, Kosti Kontaravdis, and today, as Ruby is away, I'm joined by Max and our guest, Charlie Smith, the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer at the iconic fashion house, Loewe. Before this prestigious appointment, Charlie has worked at award-winning advertising agencies in the UK and the US, with clients including the BBC, Madison Square Garden, Microsoft, Nestle, Nike, Nokia, Tiffany & Co., and even the UK government. Here we have a marketeer who is no stranger to innovation or success, as Loewe's rapid growth feels seemingly unstoppable. So without further ado, this is the Luxury Fashion Scene, brought to you by Truant London.
It's a pleasure to be here with you both.
Thank you, mate. We start the podcast always with this question: what the is Loewe?
It's a good question. I mean, for starters, I'd just like to congratulate you on your pronunciation. Because before I joined Loewe, I think I was calling it Lo. And it's actually incredible how many different ways you can pronounce these five letters. Yeah. It all stems back to the fact that Loewe actually is one of the world's oldest luxury fashion brands. It was founded in 1846. And there was actually a guy who emigrated from Germany to Spain. And in Germany, he was known as Heinrich Loewe. And then when he was in Spain, he was known as Enrique Loewe. So it's actually a Spanish mispronunciation of a German word. But I think what's really interesting about the history of the brand is that it began as a leather making collective in its atelier in Madrid. And since Jonathan Anderson became creative director of the brand about 10 years ago, he really saw a natural connection between this kind of like history of craftsmanship and also his natural affinity with craft himself. He's an obsessive collector of ceramics and has been a big collector of art, really into the kind of the arts and craft movement itself. So I think, you know, the modern version of Loewe is really this DNA of craft is at the center of the brand. And when we talk about craft, I don't just mean like craftsmanship as in the stitching of a bag. We kind of talk about it more broadly as the joy of making things with your hands, which is one of the reasons why we have the Loewe Foundation Craft Prize, which was set up to basically support craft art around the world. And entries include kind of things made out of glass and concrete, ceramics, textiles, you know, kind of like really like you name it.
I've always wondered what it must be like to work with such a visionary like Jonathan Anderson. How has that played a role since you've started there? Correct me if I'm wrong, but was he there 5 years before you were there?
Yeah, I think it was maybe about 5 years before I got there. And the brand had already started on its kind of growth trajectory. And I remember meeting Jonathan in Madrid, and we just had a really inspiring conversation. And he's kind of like similar generation, similar age to me, and just has like an encyclopedic knowledge of, you know, art and culture. And I just thought this is someone that I'm going to really enjoy working with and learn a huge amount from, because it really kind of connects my professional experience to date, which, you know, you kind of mentioned some of the highlights of, with, you know, I actually went to art school before I went to university. So it's kind of connecting that kind of passion with my professional experience as well in a really fun way.
That's amazing. That's when the best work comes, I feel like, when you get to combine the what you want to do professionally and what you want to do creatively coming together to form something is where you really get quite special work coming through.
Yeah, and I also think like Jonathan's approach to how he connects the art into the fashion as well, I think is something that really resonates with people. I mean, certainly from my perspective, I love it because I'm constantly learning about new artists and craft artisans and around the world. And I think that's the same for customers too. You know, we just did a our women's show featured these beautiful sculptures by Linda Benglis, who's an amazing kind of artist who's been known since the 1970s. The collaborations that we've done with her really enabled me to discover kind of more about her. And hopefully that's the same for other people watching our shows too. You know, I think the idea is really to kind of bring these artists to a new audience and display their works in a new context as well. With Linda, we were also very fortunate to work with her to create a jewelry collection, which was in the show as well. So on top of displaying her works, it's kind of full circle, kind of like actually creating beautiful products with her at the same time.
I love that. And you're pushing kind of what Luwewe, which was once just known as a leather house, you know, somewhere like famous for their leather goods, now pushing them into more rooted in stuff like ceramics and jewelry and other innovations that come from some of the collabs that we're going to go start speaking about in a moment. But I wanted to also know, like, from your experience, what is your standout career moment?
In terms of at Luwewe, I think a lot of my highlights are from this last year, because, for example, we dressed Rihanna for the Super Bowl, which was an incredible moment where she also unveiled that she was pregnant for the second time. And that was a big moment for Luwewe, particularly in the US. And then we also dressed Beyonce for her world tour. We created 6 different looks. And I think the one that had the kind of the hands wrapping around her body in the kind of sequin bodysuit, which we did in a few different colors, really became the sort of the iconic outfit of her tour. So that was an amazing moment. And I think those two things contributed to us becoming the hottest brand in the world in luxury fashion in the list rankings in Q2 of this year. So I think all of those things this year, kind of like how we've connected to culture, you know, I'm hugely proud of.
Could you tell us a little bit about what that process is like in terms of how does that conversation get started and how does it end up with such an iconic moment?
Yeah, well, I think if you take Rihanna as an example, Jonathan's actually been friends with ASAP Rocky for quite a long time. Luwewe's done a few different projects with him. It was a Paola Zabitha collection. He came into the showroom and tried on a few pieces, and that turned into some quite viral content. And he's attended quite a few Luwewe shows. So it really came about organically as a conversation initially between Jonathan, ASAP Rocky and Rihanna. And then after that, the team were really engaged to create different kind of options and work together with her team to bring it to life. And it's one of those things where there's a lot of secrecy around it. So you only really know right down to the wire, you know, if it's going to happen or not. So yeah, it was a hugely exciting moment to see it all come to life.
And then the earned media on something like that is just astronomical. Just, it's crazy how all of a sudden, when you do have these huge moments like the Super Bowl, and everyone's suddenly talking about Rihanna's outfit, or when everyone's talking about a look that Luwewe has been a part of, how do you keep that momentum going? The bar is now really high of the status that you're in, of the celebrities and of the artists that you're associating with. You see also at the Met Gala the type of people that Luwewe dress and they style. You see it on the front of Vogue magazine and Kim K's first cover shoot. How do you keep that going? Do you ever think like, oh, suddenly if we were to do something with just, you know, lower tier influencers, it might not hit the same mark, it might not keep that momentum going?
Well, I think as a brand, it's all about finding attention in the attention economy. And we do that in a number of ways. Obviously, working with celebrities is an amazing way to connect to culture and get people's attention. We also have a rapidly increasing media strategy globally to complement that. But I think that we, when it comes to kind of our celebrity relations, we have a team who works very closely with Jonathan and myself to think about who are the up and coming people who resonate with Luwewe as a brand, who we have a kind of connection with in terms of like thinking about craft, whether it's like the craft of being a musician or the craft of acting, or, you know, are they particularly outspoken in on a certain topic in a certain way that we think is really interesting and progressive. So I think there's a huge amount of thought and work that goes into ensuring that we stay relevant and that we continue to develop these relationships as time progresses.
Yeah, I think the idea of trying to formulate good connections with the right kind of people that are going to reflect the right things about Loewe is also really important. You know, and I think that's that comes across from all the collaborations I've seen with celebrities. You know, your Anthony Hopkins, for example. You know, they're really just the right kind of people that I would assume to have close partnerships with Loewe.
Yeah, and I think some of them, it's designed to, you know, I noticed you smiled a bit when you said it. It's designed to put a smile on your face, because one of the things that I really enjoy about Loewe is that it's not too serious a brand. It has a playful side to it. So part of it is about thinking about unexpected people that might surprise you or amuse you that we work with. And it's not just limited to celebrity as well. You know, I think it's really interesting. If you look at TikTok, for example, we didn't have a presence on TikTok 2 years ago. We've now got over 1 million followers, and we're working with different content creators who are, you know, hugely vary. One of the best performing posts we've done recently was, you know, someone who's famous for swinging around a pole, you know, and kind of, I think that's just a really fun and, you know, interesting dialogue between what she does and Loewe as a brand that people really, you know, on TikTok have engaged with.
But it's interesting that that Loewe only started a TikTok 2 years ago. And I think it's also a testament to how much the market is changing in terms of why you started the TikTok. Obviously, you had an Instagram presence before, but obviously TikTok is associated with a much younger audience, you know, your Gen Z's. Has that been a much more of like a market shift in terms of the kind of people you're targeting?
Well, I remember when I first joined, someone kind of described Loewe as the Hermes for millennials, which kind of was quite nice sort of a few years ago, but now us millennials are getting old. So, you know, I think that how we engage with Gen Z is really important in a way of, you know, knowing that this is the new generation coming through. They're going to be the key consumers over the next 10 years. So in terms of growing the brand and growing awareness, which is our number one aim, because, you know, people still are relatively unaware of Loewe compared to other luxury brands of our size, it's super important. And I think that we try and go and play in the places where our audience are, where they're spending their time. And I could see that we'd never really kind of got into Snapchat, for example, because I kind of felt like it was, you know, more focused on the US and the Middle East. It wasn't necessarily as kind of big globally, but TikTok kind of became this undeniable phenomenon, really kind of accelerating during COVID. And also, it's just like a fascinating challenge as a brand, like how to exist on this platform that really celebrates creativity. I think Instagram is kind of very polished and all about image, whereas TikTok is all about ideas, storytelling, and creativity. So for me, that was hugely exciting, because that's like so many of the things that Loewe really stands for as a brand. And then it's like, well, how can we do it in a way that feels native to the platform, where it feels a bit less polished, you know? And I think that's also, to me, exciting, because it's a bit scary for a luxury brand when typically in luxury and fashion, everything is highly polished. So it's showing kind of some vulnerability to be okay, you know, being a bit more raw. And I think it's taken us a while to figure out exactly what our voice should be, but that journey has been like a fascinating and really interesting one to go on. It's pretty addictive as a platform. But there's also, I mean, like there are trends on TikTok that, you know, I'm not even aware of. So I really trust in the team to come to me and say, this particular thing is going to go off, even if it seems really random, like it's trending right now. And that's just from, like, you know, I think having people on the team who are Gen Z, who are kind of like in it, you know, with their mates. And I think that's like hugely important, to make sure that in your team, you have a diversity of opinion, and that you really listen as well to kind of people who are younger and maybe less experienced, but really know where it's at in terms of the way that Gen Z culture is moving. Because to me, like, the most cringy thing is when you can see something that clearly was, like, you know, done by an older person trying to connect with young people, and it's like
painful.
It's a bit off, and you're like, oh, this is, yeah.
We've got a key stat here that says in 2018, 67% of Gen Z respondents stated that they had purchased luxury items from collaborations. And that includes stuff like Louis V and Studio Ghibli's House of Moving Castle collab. Even over the last couple of days, this On Running shoe collab as well. From your experience, what is the key to an iconic collab?
I think this is a great question, because, I mean, I personally have got a bit tired of collabs. I think, you know, when you start seeing like two luxury brands collaborating with each other, to me, it kind of really waters down each brand image in a way that I don't think is productive. So we've always been incredibly careful about how we collaborate and who we collaborate with. And we really started off collaborating with Studio Ghibli as this iconic Japanese animation house because of their history of like beautifully crafted movies and tapping into that kind of like childish nostalgia that we all have for movies that we've sort of seen when we were kids, as well as I think bringing Studio Ghibli movies to a new audience as well. And I think it's just like it was such a rich kind of universe to be able to sort of play in and have fun with, that that's why I think the collab worked so well. And also because it wasn't a one shot, we did three different series with different movies, and each year I think the collaboration got richer and deeper because there was a level of trust between us and Studio Ghibli that grew, and they allowed us to kind of play more and do more things. So yeah, I think that was a great experience. And then with On, it's the first collab that we've done with another brand within footwear and apparel. So that was a big step for us. And I think it came about really organically, in the sense that Jonathan got a pair of On sneakers and absolutely loved them. And I'd seen people wearing On sneakers at loads of shoots. Quite often, like, production people, you know, in film and advertising are really in the know on stuff. And they were like all wearing them because I think they're just so incredibly comfy and also a little bit of underground. And Jonathan thought that it would be great to work with them because they were like lesser known. It's not like working with a Nike or something who, you know, that would be more expected. So it took a few years to materialize, initially of just kind of like messaging each other online, you know, completely kind of from nothing, to meeting up, going to a few of each other's events. David, one of the founders, came to one of our shows, and then really initiating the first collaboration together. And then it's something that we've developed consistently over the last couple of years. And I think, again, it's that richness that you get from like having a relationship together over time that enables you to kind of go deeper. And I think this new launch that we had, the pre-launch online yesterday and launched in our stores today, we're seeing like massive interest and queues outside stores for it. And I think it's really resonating with people.
Yeah, I mean, both of them just such great collaborations. I do want to bring it back to Studio Ghibli though, because that is genuinely one of my favorite collaborations I've seen. Everything we've been talking about before in terms of craftsmanship and the craftsmanship that Loewe has, mirrored with obviously the such detail, not only in terms of like storyline, but in terms of animation that Studio Ghibli has, and such heritage in both of these massive brands. I think it just works so nicely, like hand in hand together. What was your favorite Studio Ghibli movie as a kid?
I mean, Spirited Away, I think, is a classic, just in terms of the richness of the world of it. But I don't think anything can beat My Neighbor Totoro for pure emotion. And actually, Loewe recently sponsored the stage production of My Neighbor Totoro that was at the Barbican. I think it's been extended, the run, to another theatre in London now. And I can't advise to go and see it more, because it's absolutely beautiful the way they brought it to life on stage. I think they worked with the puppeteer, one of the puppeteers who did the Muppets, to create Totoro. And without ruining it too much for you, you know, they play with scale in the play in this epic way that, like, it made me feel like a kid watching it, you know. And I think it's that feeling that I think we also tried to capture in the collaborations, where it's like that kind of joy and kind of wonder, and that's through things like we really tried to bring the craft element into the products as well. So you'd have a sweater that was kind of beautifully embroidered with one of the characters, and the rings were actual kind of, like, you know, real stones that were attached to the jumper on top. Or there were leather bags that used this intarsia technique, which is essentially like a kind of jigsaw of different colored pieces of leather that you basically then connect together seamlessly to create the image, which is incredibly technically challenging to do. So I think that's what kind of was really nice about it, was that the craft went both across the movies and the products themselves.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's beautiful to see how nicely that kind of stuff resonates. I also love My Neighbor Totoro as well. It's one that I watched more recently. I think it was in Paris that you guys did a inflatable Howl's Moving Castle as well.
Yes, we took it to London as well. It was by Marble Arch in London, by the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And that was, I think, again, really trying to think of unexpected ways to advertise. And creating an inflatable Howl's Moving Castle just seemed like a really fun thing to do. I was actually a little bit sad that we couldn't get it up into the air. But I think the thing that was really cool about it is, like, lots of people actually kind of made a pilgrimage to it to film it and put it on social media. And then we filmed it ourselves, and the video was viewed kind of millions of times. So it really showed that if you create moments like that, that are physical, they amplify massively digitally as well. So yeah, that was definitely a really fun thing to do. And we actually, we donated it to Studio Ghibli. So they've recently created a theme park in Japan. So I hope to see it when I go and visit.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, it's really nice to see that art being reinvented and being placed into fashion. I think it's obviously, it goes for the same with your collaboration with Sotheby's. How was that collaboration working with them? How did that start?
Yeah, so I mean, that's one of those things where I'd been kind of really interested in the collaborations that Sotheby's were doing, and also just this idea of Sotheby's emerging as an entertainment company. Like, some of the recent landmark auctions that Sotheby's have done have been viewed like tens of millions of times online, if not hundreds of millions. So it's almost this idea of art as entertainment, art as spectacle, auction as entertainment, auction as spectacle. And like thinking of Sotheby's as not just an auction house, but like an entertainment company, and therefore a brand that has an audience that I think it would be really interesting for Loewe to cross-pollinate with. That's how the conversation came about. And this series of Galician chestnut roasters, we worked with different artists to embellish in different ways. We had a ceramic artist make additional pieces that included eyes and tongue. This one kind of is with leather. Others were with different kind of off-cut materials from our collections that we were reusing and reimagining in different ways. And then Sotheby's exhibited them in New York, and then they were also available for purchase through the Sotheby's website. So it was a really nice collaboration. It was around the kind of COVID time, so the whole digital components of it enabled us to kind of, you know, bring the collection to a wider audience than we were able to do just through displaying them in our stores.
I think it's really interesting the way you talk about the collaboration with Sotheby's and the craftsmanship. When you think about just the audience for something like that versus perhaps some of the more perhaps Gen Z targeted items like the Pixel t-shirt and hoodie, it's really interesting just how wildly different those two audiences seem just when talking about it. There are some items that have been considered as viral items. How do you differentiate between an iconic design versus what could be considered a bit of a gimmick?
I think that's a really interesting point. And for me, I'm just speaking kind of for myself here. I personally feel that if, as a company, we are authentic to the notion of craft and we don't pursue innovation for innovation's sake, then we won't be gimmicky. So I often say to the team that to me, innovation should be the byproduct of us in marketing communication trying to craft things in beautiful and unexpected ways, not following innovation for its sake. Like in marketing communication, that means like not running into Web3 just because other people are doing it, only doing it if we feel that there's an experience that really merits it, that tells something about the brand. I think the same thing applies with Jonathan's vision for the creativity and the products themselves. If we take, for example, the Pixel pieces that were in the show, that was really around the concept of playing with the blurring between our physical and our digital realities. So I think this concept of creating something that looks digital in a physical space was something that really interested him as a concept. And I think because it had that kind of like rationale and that thinking behind it, it had a sort of a depth to it that resonated with people, where it wasn't just pixelating something for the sake of it. The same thing applies to what people have now termed the Polly Pocket looks from another show. Those actually were incredibly innovative in terms of the craft of them, because it was a molded leather technique where it was so kind of stiff in the fabrication that it almost became toy-like, but actually it was made out of leather. You know, almost like trompe l'oeil, it is not exactly how it seems. It's something very interesting in this era where in the digital world, lots of things aren't how they seem. Things are retouched or airbrushed or created by AI. And Jonathan is doing that in an analog way, which I think is super interesting. And actually, when I first joined Loewe, I tried to continue that into our marketing communication as well. So I was often thinking, what's the most analog thing we could do in a digital channel? And exploring the tension between those two things was really interesting.
And did you land on anything?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, the inflatable Howl's Moving Castle is quite a good example, right? It's like a very analog, physical thing that then manifests itself online. And, you know, we've done other films using stop frame animation, like just basically trying to really like bridge that gap between the physical and the digital, I think is something as a company that we play with a lot. And I think has a lot of room for kind of creativity and to be further kind of like developed. Even when we're creating digital experiences, it's like, how can we make them look really physical? How can we go into like the fibers of each kind of like piece of this material, even if we're 3D rendering it, you know, and really like thinking about the craft of animation or the craft of illustration online. So those are, I think, areas and territories that there are endless possibilities in, particularly as new technology emerges.
And is there any technology that you feel enticed by at the moment? You spoke briefly then about Web3.
Well, I mean, we just actually created an experience for a pop-up store in Dubai for our collaboration with On Running that has an interactive floor to the pop-up, where when you walk, the entire floor is like a giant screen that interacts with your footsteps to create the feeling of like floating and bounce of the cloud tilt sole itself. So that's something I think that's a really good example where we're kind of bridging these digital and physical worlds to tell the story of like the collaboration and the product and the innovation behind it. I think, you know, we're also thinking a lot about how we can augment our physical experiences through like extended reality. My only thing is that I think that it's only really now that the technology in augmented reality and virtual reality is becoming good enough to have highly crafted experiences within those worlds. I think when you look at a lot of the initial experiences, they kind of felt a bit gimmicky because they were quite cartoonish, you know? And I think particularly as a luxury fashion brand, where it's all about quality and the craftsmanship and the details, you need to be able to create an experience that is beautifully crafted and is wonderful, versus something that, while it's cool technology, is potentially like a bit meh, especially when you're thinking about rendering clothing, for example. I think that's kind of like one of the final frontiers in terms of like 3D is materiality. And it really reminds me actually as well of, like, you know, I kind of like studied art history, and a lot of like the famous like old masters paintings were really focused on materials, rushed and kind of like bunched kind of draping, for example, just because it's so complex to create, and that's in 2D. So imagine creating that in 3D. I think the moment sort of someone really figures out how to make a beautiful dress as a 3D render that when someone walks, moves in like a natural, beautiful way, is going to be a game changer for the industry for sure.
There's almost a theater and gravitas that comes with the presence and the movements of certain clothes. And I think that's only further recognized at some of Luewe's runways and some of the spring summer collection shows and some of the fashion week shows. Could you talk a little bit about what it's like working in that world? Because that's something that is wildly different from anything you typically have to do in your advertising experience. It is a whole exhibition in itself that involves a lot of thinking, a lot of craft, and happens so quickly, comes around so quickly. The next collection, by the time it's over, it's almost like you have to get started straight away on the next one and the story. And tell us a little bit about what it's like working to that pace.
Well, I think during COVID, I actually really missed fashion shows, because it's an adrenaline-filled moment that is kind of the denouement, the climax of the season and all of the things that you've been working to up to that point. And it's just a massive event that now has also become like a big content engine, where not only do you live stream it on multiple platforms around the world from multiple different angles, it's a really kind of like boosted by the celebrity attendance at the show, and a whole load of additional content is created off the back of it that then exists for months afterwards. I think there's a reason why after COVID, a lot of people were wondering, is this the end of the fashion show? Really, it's like, it's the most efficient way to tell the story of the collection and generate content off the back of it, which is why kind of, you know, shows came back so quickly. But they're definitely really exciting things to work on, because they only last for about, you know, 15 minutes. So it's all of this work for, you know, a short period of time, where you want everything to be perfect. But that in itself is really exciting. I know that, you know, everyone who comes to work at Luewe, you know, who hasn't kind of worked in fashion before, like, fashion shows are one of the things I think that they most look forward to being a part of. Because there's also a really great sense of team, because it's a moment where it brings together, you know, so many different disciplines to kind of create this moment together.
The other thing that often comes up around luxury fashion is this idea of exclusivity, which is a big part of the brand and the products that you make. But in your opinion, how can luxury brands be better at dismantling the wall of exclusivity around them? And that goes not just for the products itself, it's like the people who can afford it, it's the diversity in models and designers, and the practices that you were just speaking of when you create these fashion shows as well.
Yeah, well, I think that with Luewe, one of the things that we're trying to do is to create a more accessible luxury brand. And what that really means is that it's somewhere that if you're kind of walking down the street, you don't feel unwelcome in terms of kind of like walking into the door. I think Luave is a Spanish brand, and part of that Spanishness is the warmth and the friendliness and the casualness of the brand. But to me, that's also, I think, what modern luxury is about. I think modern luxury isn't stuffy. It's not kind of like that old exclusive hierarchy. It's really just making beautifully crafted things and connecting to culture. And that really kind of, you know, is luxury. I also think, just going back to the sustainability point, you know, I think maybe it was Derek Blasberg who said something along the lines of, to me, modern luxury is buying something in the knowledge that I'm not messing up the planet. And I think because of the higher price point, luxury brands really can innovate in terms of, you know, new materials and sustainable practices in a way that more mass consumer companies aren't able to because of costs. So to me, that's a clear area that brands should kind of progress in. But I think for me overall, it's like modern luxury is being more sustainable. It's being more open, inclusive, diverse, friendly, casual.
And I think that is quite a nice little segue into one of our final bits, because I'm aware that we only have you for another 11 minutes and we want to make the most of it. How do you maintain this top spot that you're experiencing at the moment?
One of the interesting challenges for us as a company as we grow is how we retain the creative edge that we have and the sense of exclusivity in a good way, which is that feeling of, I've got some Luave and I'm kind of in the know. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I used to work with Nike, and I think Nike in its history have done in a really interesting way, where whilst becoming a really big company, they do lots of kind of smaller collaborations and interesting like limited edition products, where I think you, as a customer, you can still feel like, I'm really in the know to, you know, be a part of this, while also it connecting to a larger brand. So for me, that's an inspiration. We're obviously miles away from Nike in terms of size and being a kind of mass consumer company. But I think as we grow, a lot of the interesting dynamic is going to be how can it still feel like we're niche as we become bigger?
And do you think that staying close with some of these key cultural figures, the likes of ASAP Rocky, Beyonce, Rihanna, is that staying close with them on their journey, or is that still staying very rooted in what you do and expressing yourself in these other ways that you were just speaking about?
Yeah, for sure. It's about maintaining those relationships, but also kind of like playing with scale. So, you know, working with up and coming people, I think, doing different projects in different cities around the world where we're really connecting to local culture so that it doesn't just feel like big global projects and nothing else. And I think that, again, going back to Nike, that's another thing that I think Nike have done in a really interesting way. Like, I'm sure we all remember the Nike Londoner campaign, which could only have really been written by someone based in London, because it was connecting to like really kind of like niche local culture of different parts of London, even, you know. And I think that's a really interesting thing to kind of like, you know, think about as you scale, is do you have the people in place who have the local knowledge to help you as a brand really connect to local people in that way, where they're like, okay, this brand like gets me because they really understand like the culture of my day-to-day existence. I think that's, you know, that's an important element to have, as well as obviously like bringing new things to your audience, whether it's kind of like, you know, new artists or interesting kind of new projects.
Yeah, I think it's just about being as innovative as possible throughout the process, I guess. I also think that becoming viral, virality, and it plays such a big role in all of this. And I was just curious, like, to what degree is that a thought when you're putting out a project such as the Howl's Moving Castle or something else more physical like the Sotheby's collection, is it a thought before you're actually going into the collaboration, or is it more of just an external factor?
Well, I think that really reminds me of like when I first started working in advertising was kind of around the time that digital video was quite kind of nascent, but YouTube was becoming bigger and there was this whole thing of the viral video. And I think, you know, clients would be like, I want a viral video. And in agencies, we were having to tell them, you can't just have a viral video, you know, like we can try, but it doesn't work like that. I think it's hard to fully predict the cultural zeitgeist, but I think what you can do as a brand is try and kind of connect to culture in unexpected and interesting ways continuously. And I think if you do that, the probability that one of those things will go viral becomes quite high. But it's very hard to predict exactly which one.
Yeah, I kind of liken it to a musician releasing an album, and they might think that track two is going to be the one that really blows up, but it actually turns out to be track eight. You don't really know. It's just you need to create a whole bunch of things that you really believe in and are innovative enough and, you know, creative and fun enough to really have the chance of doing that. It also just reminds me of, in terms of the pieces that you've released recently, you know, talking about the puzzle bag and the anagram tank top. Obviously, both of those, I think both of those were in the list, top 10 hottest items. In terms of the tank top, I was just interested, was that a piece that you knew was really gonna, you know, like, quote unquote, blow up?
It's interesting. I mean, the tank top was very much, I mean, Jonathan just had this idea of creating a simple white tank and just putting that, like, tiny logo in the middle of it as something that was kind of an iconic piece. But I don't think you can ever necessarily predict that it's going to blow up the way that it did. But I think what you can do as a company is be agile enough to be on the lookout for pieces that might be blowing up, and then when they are, to really like double down on them to ignite the fire. And I think that's kind of I think what we've been able to do as a company is really get behind those items that have potential for virality and help kind of, you know, boost them into the stratosphere. And then the question of like making sure that we have the next kind of potential hot kind of viral pieces to come as well, so that you don't rest on your laurels for too long either.
Yeah, good shout. I think Kylie Jenner also helped a little bit with the tank top.
Yeah, exactly. With pieces like that, it's all about seeing them on the right people. I think that's really kind of what takes them to the next level.
For sure. And interestingly, today I think you're wearing a JW Anderson piece.
I am. Yeah, I'm supporting Jonathan's own brand.
We love that.
Yeah.
Charlie, I noticed that we're coming up to the end of the podcast. We'd love just one little hot take. We've been trying to get different scenes giving us different understanding of how this cultural phenomenon is occurring right now that is AI. And just ask, how do you see AI playing a role in the future of luxury fashion and in the future of Loewe?
So I have an interesting take on AI and luxury in that for me, what's increasingly luxurious in a digital world is human touch and human interaction. And I think the same thing applies to luxury products in that you know that something is like hand created by another human. It's not mass produced by a machine. So I think extrapolating that a bit, I don't think that in the foreseeable future, AI in luxury will be a consumer-facing product or a consumer-facing tool. But I think where it really will help is kind of on the back end and behind the scenes in terms of simplifying a whole load of processes and also aiding creativity. you know, whether it's kind of mood boarding or, you know, kind of researching ideas, all of that kind of thing. So I think as an aid to kind of like the human touch, I think it's going to be incredibly powerful and luxury. But where I think it's a bit off the mark is when I see people being like, oh, this is an AI created handbag, or this is like an AI created advertising image. Because I mean, that might end up being the case in other areas, but I feel like in luxury fashion, like, it's going to be all about the human.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think in terms of having a piece that I really believe in, there needs to be some kind of story behind it, or some kind of like heritage point behind how the collaboration came together, or like we were saying earlier on in the podcast about how you just met the person that you're eventually going to collaborate with, you know, and knowing those kind of stories is what makes part of the piece for me. And I think that it all being well and fine and interesting to have a piece that was purely created via AI, it doesn't have any of that. And I think that's where, like, for me at least, the conversation kind of it kind of stops in terms of whether I'm going to invest my time and money into it. Because, you know, I think with such a culturally rich brand as Loewe, you know, it really has to have that, right?
Yeah, and I also think, I mean, fundamentally, I've seen very little creativity by AI so far that's been any good. I think like the best thing I've seen is when the Pope looked like he was in Montclair. But to be honest, that's a human's idea. It's just like the AI that executed it in a good way. And I, you know, I remember I went to this this talk a few years ago in London, which was called like "A Robot Stole My Job: Will Creativity Become the Refugee Camp of the Future for Humanity?" And I think that while that is a very kind of like overblown title to a talk, I think that AI certainly is going to be more successful initially in process-driven tasks, because I think creativity is so complex as a kind of notion, because it's immensely subjective. And really, kind of when we talk about good creativity, what we're really talking about is when enough people think that something looks or sounds great, but also the people who are considered to sort of like have taste within society. You know, it's not just enough people in terms of volume, because otherwise there are loads of things on the internet that have, you know, sort of like big fan bases, but we don't necessarily consider them to be creatively amazing. So for me, I think it's just like, I'm sure that at some point the algorithms will get smart enough to be able to generate some things that are kind of like creatively interesting. But I think that's probably still quite far away, just bearing in mind how, like, I remember when I first kind of, you know, the start of my career, going back to like 2008, people were getting really excited about augmented reality experiences on your mobile phone, where you would scan a QR code and, you know, you'd be able to, on a cereal box or in a magazine, you'd then see a 360 of a car. And that's like years ago, and we still now really are only finally mastering AR on our phones, and it turns out that it's all about face filters, you know. So
yeah,
I think that we can't really predict yet the direction that it's going to go in. I think like we have the technology and we don't necessarily have the use cases yet.
I want to give a shout out to Blipper for their role at that particular time, because I remember everything was suddenly coming to life, and now it's it must be a massive shame to see. The only thing we want to see is like what we look like blonde.
Yeah, exactly. And the QR code basically has become the restaurant menu, you know.
Yeah,
and your kind of like airport accompaniment for like flights and or train tickets. So it's just interesting to see how, you know, in the initial phases of technology, we kind of have all of these different hopes for their uses. And then, you know, it's hard to predict when the usefulness is going to kick in and what direction it's going to take it in.
Yeah, that's awesome. If we had more time, I'd almost want to chat about like the integration of technology, because I know Max saw a garment that had like embedded NFC chips, which told stories. And I'd love to know, you know, how, what Luewe might do in that field. Maybe you can tell it better.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was at a marketing conference, and it was interesting because it was actually Levi's. And obviously, you know, the Levi's badge on the back of their jeans, which hasn't been changed in, you know, in how many years. Again, a very like heritage rich brand.
Except the E went from uppercase to lowercase, and that's how you can tell a vintage pair from.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Okay, interesting. I didn't know that. All right. Well, since then, they hadn't changed it, and they just implemented an NFC tag, which I thought was an interesting idea in terms of what to do. But this specific pair of jeans was like a rental pair, and if you scanned the tag, you could basically input your story of, you know, where you've been with these jeans, what experiences you had with them, what countries you went to, blah blah blah, all of this stuff. And I guess the overall narrative was to create a story, going back to that point of like storytelling, right? And just kind of burrowing into that a little bit more, which I thought was interesting. Again, not necessarily revolutionary as we expect AI and AR and all these like crazy words to be, but they just kind of find their own place, especially in fashion, where everything's so touch-based, you know, and it's all very intimate. It's clothing that we're going to wear. I think you can't really be able to see that on like a screen or on a VR headset. It doesn't really go the full way, does it?
I mean, my take on that example you just gave is like, who really wants to like put in the history of like their jeans into the jeans themselves?
I couldn't agree more.
I mean, I even remember like Burberry did this thing where, like, I don't know if it was NFC or RFID they had in some of their coats, and basically when you walked past the store, it would like activate, and then you could see like the making of your piece like on the screen. Again, I mean, that to me sounds more like a gimmick than anything else. I think, when, you know, we did a men's show recently where we played around with technology and clothes, and we had a coat that was made out of like iPads, where it would have like kind of like films playing across the iPads, so the coat itself was becoming like a screen. And also the models had like flexible LED screens like wrapped around their heads. And in that show, we also had pieces that had grass actually growing out of them that were grown in a greenhouse over a number of weeks, because Jonathan was really interested in like this interplay between like nature and technology and the kind of the future that we're moving towards. And I, you know, while that was more of just an exploration of like what could be possible in the future, I do think that there's something in the idea of fabrics which can change. And I think that that is going to be developed in the not too distant future. So you could have like, say it's like a sweater that changes color. So you can basically just like change the color of your outfit, like because you feel like it.
Yeah.
And this idea of like your clothing being a screen, I think is kind of interesting too. And I think we probably will get to the point where it's possible through the actual like yarns of the fabric itself, not just like using LEDs. And I think that could be a whole new frontier in clothing.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what year it was, but it kind of reminds me of when Stone Island, I think it was a collaboration with Supreme, did that piece where the coat was reactive to your touch, right? And I've seen that kind of material on like tables and stuff like that. I mean, I think that's it's an interesting start, and like,
or like those
stuff like that, I'm interesting where to go.
Like,
yeah. Stuff like that. It's just like, it's cool. I can imagine maybe being a bit awkward if you get really hot in public, but like, it's definitely like a jumping off point, right?
Yeah, totally. And I think it's just really interesting to kind of like try and push the boundaries of what's possible in those areas. But yeah, I think NFC and RFID, again, are kind of the technologies that I think are going to be used much more in terms of like supply chains and logistics to make sure that like stock doesn't get lost and ends up in the right place, really, than it is in final kind of consumer facing marketing strategies, you know?
Yeah, I also saw that in the same time I saw the Levi's jeans, they had a kind of makeshift rail of where they're holding the jeans, and on the kind of rail they had an NFC tag. So if you couldn't find your size, for example, that NFC tag would take you to the website where you could just see if you could purchase them online, stuff like that. I just think it will come into factors where it just makes your life slightly easier in terms of finding stuff logistically.
Yeah, exactly. In the same way that I think, you know, smart mirrors will become a thing when, going back to what we were talking about before, 3D renders of clothing are actually good enough, because you're only going to use a smart mirror if you can try on a garment that you know is how it actually is in the store. Otherwise, it's a completely pointless exercise, you know? But already, like, you know, we've developed the virtual try-ons for sneakers using AR, and that works really well, you know, where you can just kind of like point at your shoe and like imagine what it's going to be like to own a pair. So it's like, I think that kind of thing is definitely coming in the near future as well.
Awesome. And does that mean that there may be room for virtual items as well? If you're already starting to use technology that lets you try on, perhaps there's something that you could own in that space?
I think we'll have to see on that one. I think, you know, for us, we're very much committed to physical products and, you know, using the digital world to basically connect better together with, you know, other humans to sell things physically. It remains to be seen for me, like, how this whole idea of like digital avatars and digital worlds are going to evolve. I mean, I certainly think that an area that is interesting, I don't know if you recently saw Mark Zuckerberg in conversation using the new Meta VR technology where he had a fully rendered face. So it was like a lifelike avatar of himself speaking.
And I haven't, but it sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it's pretty terrifying, but also amazing at the same time, because I think it really opens up the idea of virtual reality and augmented reality as a better way to be doing like video conference, a more realistic way to be doing video conference. And I think in that world, I could then understand how if you were, say, doing a important like video conference business meeting, you might want to have a virtual like Loewe shirt on in that meeting. But I don't think like the whole thing of creating like a skin for a computer game is like the future of luxury products.
And on that note, Charlie, thank you so much for giving us all this extra time as well. We really appreciate it, mate.
No worries. Thanks, guys. It was great to chat to you both.
Yeah. And we'll be in touch soon.
Nice one.
Cool.
Thank you very much, man. Appreciate it.
Have a lovely day.
Nice one. Take care, man.
Thank you for listening to The Luxury Fashion Scene, brought to you by Truant London. Our producers are Lucy Austin and Max Ryby-Williams. Our technical director is Tom Kemp. Today's episode was hosted by myself, Kosti Kontaravdis, and Max Ryby-Williams.